This is module 17. I believe this is November 17th.
Yes.
Oh, very auspicious.
Very auspicious. Looking at self and selflessness. So, we've been studying this word, self and selflessness, egolessness, no self. We've heard it since the very beginning of our studies, our Dharma studies. What are we talking about when we talk about self or selflessness? It's we've had so many assumptions about that, and it's become, ego has become part of our vernacular, certainly. Psychologically, but also sort of we throw that term around a lot, that guy's on an ego trip, or that person is so selfless. And but clearly we're talking about something slightly different than that. So who is this self that we're committed to? So committed to, and why does thinking about non-self or emptiness or selflessness make us so nervous? Why do we resist it so much? So this is the subject that Emily and I have been chewing through. Well, we've all been chewing through this for over 40 years. Let's just get that on the table. But in terms of this class.
I have this nice image of bookworms, you know.
Yes. Really
how about tearing your hair out?
That could be closer.
Just coming through the Prajnaparamita Sutra, the Heart Sutra, what are we talking about all the way through that? We're talking about emptiness, no self. What do we mean? No eye, no ear, no nose, no tongue, no body, no mind. What are we talking about? So this module is really going to be a wonderful opportunity for us as well to work with this material. So, and as is clear as we work through the path, you're marrying the Dharma to your life experience enables you to understand things in a different way as you go along your own path. So I would have to say that I'm still learning things and will until the moment I kick the bucket, I suppose. And I think that's what we've also been talking about is one of the reasons we really wanted to tackle this class is because we want to know what we're talking about.
Yeah, it does. It's all about me.
I want to know that Emily knows that I know what I'm talking about. So, let's see. How fundamentally, and I've taken millions of notes, forgive me, that I'm going to be using them pretty straightforwardly. How can things appear solid, permanent and singular, such as the wall we'd prefer not to drive into, and still be non-substantial. So we're going to talk about that. We're going to discuss that. And it's essentially going to be an investigation of these. We'll be having readings and other supports, including will be a little self-directed and group-directed, and we'll be using audio recordings and some DVDs. We'll be utilizing some of the DVDs of Pema Chodron, who did a 6-week program on this at Gampo Abbey in Nova Scotia, and has some fantastic step-by-step ways of working with this material. And also using guided exercises in what's called analytical meditation. We've been watching tapes of Tyler Dewar, who is a teacher in Dzogchen Panlop Rinpoche's Sangha, who's quite wonderful. And Emily was actually at those talks, so you can see her periodically. In
Did you ask a question at one of those?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, I did ask a question. Right. Yeah, that was great. I'm so glad I did. I still don't know the answer, though.
Sandra has been reading some of this material already. John has also, who hasn't been here in a while, but we'll sort of be jumping in a little bit, just so that we can get to, we can work with some them also, and they'll be working, taking on some of the responsibility, because it's really good to get this from a lot of different perspectives, and we'll all learn something. We'll all learn quite a bit. Did anybody, by the way, get a chance to read the material that was posted?
I read the shorter thing.
Okay.
The introduction.
Okay. Well, I had read, you know, I have
Right. Oh, wonderful. That's fine. We're always at the beginning of this material, so...
Really?
Just because you read it once or 10 times does not mean that you may know a whole lot more than somebody who's reading it just for the first time. So let's just be generous to ourselves as we go through this. So this is fundamentally an introduction to the to this new course. And I wanted to start out by saying we're essentially going to be using our experiences to find out what is true for ourselves in the Dharma. Not just what we've read, but we will be actually looking at our experiences of how things occur in our minds, of how we feel in our bodies, how the external world, what is inside, outside. We're going to be doing these. So it's essential, actually, at this point, because you've all been working really diligently with this material. And this is a big issue and a foundational issue for the Buddha Dharma. We can't keep talking about emptiness or spaciousness or letting go of a concept of ourselves without of conception, of conceptual mind, without confronting this material and incorporating it. So are we really solid? Are we singular? There's just one you. Are we permanent? We probably could say yes, no, maybe. Is there a me that any of us can hold on to as a permanent, solid, singular identity? So we've heard this before, and in a sense it isn't new, but the way we're going to approach it is really new, and it's kind of, we're actually very excited about it, kind of a bit like jumping off a cliff, and that's kind of what makes it very exciting, actually, at this point. So we're going to be studying the components that make up our experience when we study the structure of the development of ego, of our ego, how we build a sense of me, of ourselves, through some of the material we've already studied, which we will be looking at again. The skandhas.
Oh,
yeah.
Hold on. But wait, there's more.
But you've already wet, you know, put your fingers in the, your toes in the water. So it may be less, it may be more
comfortable. Don't count on that.
Really. Okay. We're also going to be studying the three marks of existence, which you probably have, I don't know if you studied that before No.
It was the Dzongsar Kensei book,
right.
What just Makes You Not a Buddhist. Oh, remember that one? You loved it.
Those three marks are impermanence, egolessness, and suffering. They're very basic. They're very basic to the tenets of Dharma. Also the Four Noble Truths. The truth of suffering, the cause of suffering, the cessation of suffering, and the path that leads to the cessation of suffering. We're very familiar with that. So what are we really talking about? So I thought I'd just do a little background on those, if that suits you. Yeah. I'll talk about the Four Noble Truths. Do we agree that with the First Noble Truth, that life is suffering? Maybe we do, maybe we don't. From the Buddhist perspective, you'd say there's a constant undercurrent of anxiety, physical or psychological, even when things are going beautifully. Even when you're holding your beloved, there's this implied in that is that you are not the same as your beloved, that there's a separation in there. So there's the pain of attachment to either keeping your body, thinking that you will always be this way, or the situation will always be this way. So the suffering of the pain of attachment to anything. Then the cause of suffering, craving, fundamental ignorance, the endless and unreachable effort to maintain the delusion that we are solid and permanent. I can't remember where I read that, but I like that very much. It takes a lot of effort to maintain the delusion that we're solid and permanent. It's an endless and unreachable effort. So the truth of suffering, if we acknowledge that, that there's this under, if we even slightly acknowledge that, there's an undercurrent of dis-ease, we realize the reason for it is we are always feeling threatened, the thing that the rug is going to be pulled out from under us. Somehow we're kind of built that way, in a sense, to watch out, to be careful. At least the third noble truth, which is the cessation of suffering, which is the really good news. There's a possibility that we can cut this, that we can cut our resistance to trying to hold our world together. We can cut our resistance to change. And we can stop trying to hold everything together, to control every little thing, by being fully present and flexible to whatever occurs, without feeling we have this huge country that we're defending. The country of me. It's actually doable. And that leads us to the fourth noble truth, the path of cessation of suffering. And the techniques used for that are the ones that come to play with our module, which are studying, contemplation, meditation, the Eightfold Path. So those studying, contemplation and meditation are what's called the three prajnas, the three kinds of knowledge, or the threefold training. So that's what we're really going to be doing with this module. Some people really like doing this. Some people not so much.
I'd like to state, I really liked doing it. I think analytical meditation is way cool.
Yeah, good.
There's one data point for you.
There you go.
True.
Good. So we really could use, this module is a time to really like roll our sleeves up and talk about our real, our genuine experience. Not everybody loves doing this, but we can all work with it. And so really contribute. Like this is very exciting actually for us to be doing this. So I thought yes.
So it's, I remember from the reading, it's listening and then...
Listening and study. So listening...
Study.
I'm actually just going to talk about this that right now. The first one is called hearing. The first prajna. Listening to talks. Hearing teachers. Attending teachings. Reading is another form of basically absorbing the Dharma. Absorbing the teachings. Sort of hearing them, you don't just sort of hear them, so 1 + 1 = 2, they kind of enter you and you're impregnated with, actually you want to get impregnated with this, here you go, with this kind of information or this kind of perspective of looking at things. None of us would be here if we didn't actually hunger for this on some level and recognize on some level that something that's conventional way that we've been interacting with the world and the world seems to interact isn't all there is to the story. We wouldn't be here otherwise. So that's what we're doing. With listening, we're tuning ourselves to the attitude of hearing on a deeper level. Contemplating, the second prajna, it personalizes the material that we're absorbing. What does it really have to do with my experience? Internally, how do we actually work with a personable truth? Do we really believe that? Let's analyze it. Let's actually look and see if that is so. Maybe it isn't so. Maybe you're happy all the live long day and everything is going to be fine because it's going to be fine. But I suspect that all of us having reached this age, we've all had an experience where things aren't so fine. So how do we deal with this? We know we can't deal with it if we're holding on so tightly to an idea of who we think we are and what we need for everything to be perfect. We have to be flexible and present. So at any rate, the second prajna is talking about really looking into the shadow anxiety that we might feel or the loneliness, sense of separation. In my own experience, sort of watching my son graduate from high school and college and having this profound sense of joy and dread at the same time. You know, even bringing this beautiful child into the world thinking, oh my, this, he's going to be in the world. How can I do that? So this joy is sort of the truth of sort of this underlying anxiety is true for me. And I can see in that example. So we'll look at that. And of course that means we have to look at the reality of death. We haven't talked all that much about that. But in terms of letting go of our holding on tightly to who we think we are, that certainly is. That's the big messenger. So
I'd like to add something to that.
Yeah.
I had read when Emily had brought that up, Prajna Contemplation, I had read by an author, Reginald Ray.
Yes.
He just had a small little excerpt, and it also said, in seeing how your own experience relates with everything that you've seen, before you said, if you do contemplation, it really helps settle the mind because we're naturally unsettled. And I have been doing that personally, a lot of the contemplation on a lot of the things that we talk about here. And it's been very helpful. But to hear it, the first time I actually heard it was when Emily had mentioned it, you know, with the prajna, but to hear that phenomenon put into words really crystallized it for me.
Yeah, I actually read not just the material for today, but I read some of Reggie Ray for this class as well. And we certainly know him from years back. He was part of
it. I just Googled it, actually. Susan was saying Google earlier, but I had Googled prajna contemplation.
Good.
And there was a Google book online that was free, The Indestructible Truth. And
basically, by Reggie?
That's his book.
That's his book.
And that had that excerpt right
that
there.
That excerpt.
Very good.
Wonderful. Wonderful. So actually, this is so great because you've got a world of resources actually that we never had coming up. But and some mighty amazing teachers. You look like you have a question.
Yeah, I'm waiting for us to get to the meditation.
Right? Oh, okay.
Just because I have a question. Yeah. Sandra said analytical meditation is really cool.
It's different from the meditation we've been doing.
So it's not, that's my question.
That's right.
It's not shamatha and vipassana.
It's much more active. It's not shamatha, it's not vipassana. It's a completely different.
It contains some thinking, but it's okay to think in this context, which is as part of it.
It actually, yeah.
Okay,
that's
then
right.
You'll tell us actually how to do it. Do we stand on our
head? Absolutely.
Instead of sitting hanging from the rafters? Okay.
Absolutely, yeah. This is why this module is kind of different and exciting and requires. I think you'll actually enjoy it. During meditation itself, the act of meditation sets us up to appreciate what we're talking about egolessness. Every out breath ends in a gap. So we're actually familiar before we breathe in again. So we're actually experienced with this space of gap. It isn't like, and emptiness. So it isn't that this is something that you're unfamiliar with. Excuse me, it's just that we don't spend any time recognizing it or acknowledging it. In fact, our tendency is to either fill our heads with a lot more thoughts, or anytime we feel a gap where we feel our reference points have weakened, we rush to the refrigerator, or we turn on the television, or we turn on the radio, we call someone. So what we're talking about is actually experiencing and acknowledging fully something that is already part of our experiential vocabulary. But in terms of in terms of the third prajna, this spaciousness that occurs when we meditate is the basis of unconditioned reality without a reference point. We deliberately resist surrendering to any distraction from simply being in the present moment. We cut our discursive thinking and keep coming back to the present moment where you've got to admit not much is going on. It's kind of boring. Let's gin up the next thing. But no, as meditators, we've discussed exertion. Nobody's making us sit there and follow the meditation technique. Our own exertion is what's enabling us to work with our own minds and train our own minds to bring ourselves back to simply being here in the present moment.
So this is still the old meditation.
Correct. Correct. Yeah. Correct. I gave you a little taste, I just said we were going to be doing analytical meditation during the course. But I wanted to talk about the three different prajnas, the three kinds of learning. So that's hearing, contemplating, and meditating.
Old meditating. Okay.
Yeah. So, from progressive stages in emptiness, there was a quote I liked very much. Although people vary as to how much time they have to spend at each stage, everyone needs each stage of the process if they are to reach liberation. Meditation without listening and reflecting is blind. But listening and reflecting without meditation is like having eyesight but no legs. I thought that was really kind of interesting. Mm-hmm. And I've certainly known people who are mega meditators who have no insight into their, and no, they have done no contemplation about the world around them or how they function in it. They're, the one thing they can do is be on the cushion. And there's a problem because we are in the world, and the bravest thing we can do is keep coming back to being in our world, to functioning in our world, to leaping, and not hiding out in habitual pattern. The other thing that came up in the reading material was relative truth and absolute truth. Have you, are you familiar with this? Not so much. Well, I'm just going to give a little slight, very brief description of it because it's something that, again, that we're going to be working with as practitioners on the path. Ordinary truth, or relative truth, is sort of our ordinary understanding about the world and about how things function. So that you know that if you want to cross the street safely, you don't do that while the light is green coming towards you. You know this. You know how to function in a sane world, or how not to get yourself killed as best you can. It's important that we know this. It isn't like this is secondary stuff. This is how we've managed to negotiate this world, navigate this world. And absolute truth is fundamentally based on emptiness. So that, in fact, from a relative point of view, even though we know how to take care of ourselves, we understand, actually, from a more absolute point of view, that there's a lot going on that we don't, that we're not familiar with. There are, how do I describe this? If somebody, let's see, that reality, that we understand how to, we understand how to get from one address to another, but from an absolute truth reality, we'd have to be a satellite, so that we can be looking down on the whole eastern seaboard, rather than just our little street, how we're getting from one place to another. And it's not predicated on our winning or losing or maintaining our selves.
So is the metaphor the idea that we're stuck in our little, all the stuff we're looking at, and we need to sort of step out? Is that what you're saying?
Yes, and how do we do that? That's what we're talking about. All of our techniques are techniques in how to step out. That's what we've been doing from the very beginning, actually. But of course we begin with, oh, I don't feel good, I'm in so much pain, I want to feel better. That's a perfectly reasonable place to begin. But the truth about Dharma is that it lets you do that. Then it goes, aha.
Guess what?
Guess it's not all about you, actually. So it's kind of like a sleight of hand. You got hooked.
So it seems like the word progression throws me off a little bit, where it's a technique to kind of deal analytically with something, but it's all happening at once. So that gets back to actually a question I had about, let's say you observe a person who seems inconsistent, that is using the meditation but not applying it. Really, that's just a perception. If most of the activity is under the radar screen, so to speak, then we don't know. Everything's happening at once. I don't mean to say it's happening all in the same amplitude, same intensity. But something is always going on. And, that's trusting in the fact that we don't know. We know so little that the progression is just a methodical way of trying to get through.
It's progressive stages of meditation on emptiness. So first we're working with taking apart our construction of self, our solid view of how we see ourselves. That's the first stage, is working with self. That's why it's Hinayana. The first stage is Hinayana, where Hinayana is all about individual liberation. So that's the first stage in that book, and it's online, so you can read the whole book or you can just take a section. I'm still on stage one. I've been doing that for 30 years. I'm hoping Sandra will get me onto the next. Then the next stage is seeing the emptiness in the world around us and objects. There's a progression from self as like finding holes in this view of self, of Emily, and then looking around to the world and seeing what's out there as well. Is there's emptiness there. So, and it goes further and further and further. So it's a progression.
Yeah, so I think one thing that I think I find, one of the things I found exciting, which may sound terrifying, is that, Erica used the phrases relative truth and absolute truth. This very small book contains six different pairings of different definitions of relative truth and absolute truth, mm-hmm. and that's the nature of the progression. And a lot of the work is sort of trying on each of those views for size and working with it, mm-hmm. But I think that's actually... I think it's sometimes the English phrase absolute truth makes you think there is exactly one truth that we're all aiming for, and there are like several different frameworks and that are progressive, but that they're not, it isn't even six views into one reality. It's six different ways of approaching the relative and absolute truth.
Good. That's great. That's very
good.
Well, it's discouraging because I had worked in the absolute truth that there's no self and there's emptiness. But the relative truth, and I read this somewhere, is that there is a me.
Oh, yeah. Wonderful.
That there's, but, I mean, that was in some of our readings. Does that contradict what Sandra, you were saying?
Well,
it's just more complicated.
There is, the me. I think would it be fair to say the me is there in the relative truths.
Sure.
And there is somebody who gets up and goes to the grocery store, right? We're not just sort of floating in the cosmos.
So that's the relative truth. The absolute truth is that there is no.
Well, is that
there's
saying?
Not even any groceries.
Yeah, so look at what the Heart Sutra says.
Yeah.
It says, first of all, form is emptiness, right? In other words, it says it, okay?
Yeah.
I didn't say you should believe it.
I don't understand it.
Okay, so let's take, that's what I wanted to mention. Form is emptiness, which means the actual, what we take to be all the real things, are, if we understand it somehow, marked by emptiness. Then you can say, okay, now I understand that all these forms are marked by emptiness, right? I can go forward into that. So the next statement, emptiness also is no other than form. So if you try to back off it now and step back and say, oh, so it's all empty, that emptiness has no existence other than in forms. So you take a step this way, it throws you back. If you step back, it throws you this way. And then it does two more things. Well, maybe I can step off to the left. Throws you back.
Right.
So maybe I can sort of ease out of it to the right. No, throws you back. Well, then I'll just sort of sit here and play dumb. But it also says no non-attainment. So
you can't do that.
You can't. It doesn't give you any resting place.
And I think in terms of what you were saying, you want to pin it down, and we're not pinning it down. It's what Michael is saying is that it's you can't pin it down. What the Prajnaparamita says is that what it is can't be pinned down.
There's no it.
There's no there. Is that the phrase? So,
Roberta?
Yeah. I think... I was thinking that I'd like the skandhas, but maybe not. But I thought form...
You were thinking you liked the skandhas?
Yeah, I don't know.
Emily sounds very surprised.
There was something... Okay, I thought form was the first skandha, or is the first something.
Well, it is the first skandha.
And I thought it was duality, basically.
Yeah.
Right? That's form is...
The duality means that I'm experiencing something. If I have an experience, then there's me and there's experience. That's form.
Right. Okay. Duality. That was the first skandha. Okay, that was what I...
That's right.
Okay.
You're correct.
Okay.
Yes, it goes... Okay.
Well, we could go on. I just had a couple of things I wanted to read from Elizabeth... Mathis Nangyal, who is the wife of Zigar Khantra Rinpoche, and also a remarkable teacher in her own right. And I read an article that she wrote on the Bardo, which I thought was really rather interesting, and she talks a lot about emptiness in that. And what she was talking about, what she was talking about is discovering a sense of well-being, even when you can't pin things down, even when you can't know for sure that I am this and that is that. How do we have a sense of? How do we hover? How do we hang out in this world if we're starting to separate ourselves from our attachment to a solid sense of ourselves? And she said, you know, even if it's not based on securing every aspect of our lives and identity, we can have a sense of well-being. And I thought that was a really interesting way to look at this, rather than the freak out that I don't exist. Like, okay. The freak out followed by resistance. So I copied some of this stuff that she wrote, and I wondered if somebody would be willing to read it.
I'd be happy to.
Yeah. Anybody wants? Would you like to?
Definitely.
Okay, both of you can. You can read from here to there. That would be great.
The point is that healing doesn't promise us that things will work out the way we initially want them to. It doesn't promise us a cure for old age, sickness, and death. It doesn't promise us a pain-free life, but it does promise a fundamental wellness, a wellness found within. Can you talk about this wellness and how to find it? What does it feel like to you, and how do you know if you're moving towards wellness, not away? The wellness has to do with our ability to include life rather than shrink from it. You could phrase that as letting life touch you. That may seem overwhelming at first, so we can do it slowly. That way we do it on this path is to listen to the teaching, such as the teaching on impermanence, because we live so much of our lives in a fantasy and don't accept the fullness of life. The Buddha encouraged us to look into the nature of suffering. This is profound and evokes deep compassion and courage. Then we take these teachings into our own experience and make them our own through contemplation. We can see how much we reject life by trying to fix it. I am not saying we should not respond in the best possible way, or that we shouldn't take care of our bodies or an illness, but we need to accept that the body gets ill, that we have to die, that there will be loss and so on. This is sanity and wellness found from within. I think we all see people who end up bitter because they are unable to include life. There is little courage or wisdom in this. To accept things as they are is the foundation of freedom. Lastly, when we sit and practice, we let things be. We learn to stay present without pushing away or trying to control things. This is extremely healing and sane. This comes from meditation. How do we identify wellness? I think it comes from noticing. We enter a path because most likely we see that there is something not well. As we begin to open things up, we may see a fundamental problem in the way we lead our lives. This path helps us identify and work with these challenges. We begin to examine the causes and conditions for suffering and happiness. For instance, when we are caught in self-concern, we suffer more. When we are generous and loving towards others, we feel a sense of meaning and joy. There are many methods for cultivating altruism on this path. We cannot get into them all here, but the point is when we begin to look deeply, utilizing the infrastructure of the path, we begin to identify a world of choice. Then we will start to see the difference between well-being and confusion. If we can identify pain, we certainly will know freedom when we encounter it. This is a traditional way of looking into these things, an intellectual examination that takes apart and deepens our understanding of reality. We've been using the techniques of investigation all along.
Who is this person?
Her name is Elizabeth Mattis, M-A-T-T-I-S, Namgyel, N-A-M-G-Y-E-L.
A-L.
A-L.
Is that in the readings? Do we have it?
No.
No, but I can...
She could post something.
I can post that. She's got a number of other... she's really a wonderful resource, wonderful teacher. And she also talks about the Prajnaparamita. She actually commissioned a tanka of the Prajnaparamita, her own tanka. And she was asked, I was thinking that I wanted to add something to this talk, because those of us who were here last week, we went over, the last part of the Prajnaparamita. And it was kind of a very I don't know, did anybody else? It was a very intense description of what's going on in the Prajnaparamita that we're saying. And she talks here a little bit about the use of images and and you could say certainly in the Prajnaparamita those are pretty strong images that we're talking about. And
what images?
The images at the end of the Prajnaparamita about the beings that will rejoice at the end and so on and so forth. Right. That's what we're talking about. What I'm talking about. If you can read that. It says, the whole assembly in the world with its gods, humans, asuras, and gandharvas rejoiced and praised the words of the festival.
So she commissioned a painting?
She actually commissioned a painting
with
a sangha of
those images. Yeah.
Yeah. And I thought maybe it would be interesting and helpful just to tap into that, maybe unnecessary. But I felt it was sort of useful. And I'll just read it since I've got it here. It was a question about the use of deities and the language of deities in our practice. And since we've introduced this practice, I thought it would be smart to look at it. She said about this, this is a deep question, but in a simple way I can say that we all need supports. We need forms and words and teachers. We have all kinds of symbols in our lives that remind us of things or remember things. We have stop signs and green lights and flags. We have friends and relationships that support us. Certain ideas or poems remind us of important things. Alarm clocks wake us up every morning. These symbols and references are quite functional. The imagery we have in this tradition or in other traditions serve to remind us of our allegiance to something bigger. Sometimes the Buddhist images seem a bit exotic, but when we study what these images represent, we can connect to them. It doesn't mean we have to cling to them as some kind of dogma or truth. We can even enjoy images from other traditions. I love St. Francis of Assisi. I love looking at images of animals and so many other things. Hopefully we can learn to appreciate and learn from everything. That's the real point. And then she attached an image that she commissioned of Prajnaparamita, or transcendent wisdom. She represents the kind of knowing that doesn't cling to truths or rightness. You might say she represents the mind of an open question. And that's what we talked about last week, was this, what we've been talking about is this open question, and to approach this study from the perspective of an open question with ourselves, the truth of our experience as being the basis. So, any questions?
Yeah, it seems to me, if I could say my own opinion, is the word suffering seems to be dualistic, to me, I'm saying. And the word wellness is more fundamental. That is more neutral to emptiness. You know, emptiness itself is now becoming a very, fundamental word for me. But because it's non-discriminatory. So do you know what I mean? From what you say there, I think this is, incredible, wording she's using.
So the deal, how can you be well? How can you be experience this well-being?
Yeah, that's well. Maybe in that's
emptiness.
Every label is
in
prejudice.
Emptiness.
Yeah.
In not knowing.
Yeah.
In not securing your ground constantly. We live such conditioned existence. I'm happy. I'm sad. I'm cold. I'm hot. I want this, I don't want that. This is cute, that's disgusting. And we are constantly reaffirming our sense of ourself, our isness, by all these ways of limiting our... We know ourselves by our limits, almost.
Peter?
Well, we're... Yeah. I want to say a couple of things. And it gets back to what started this person's comments. And about the sense of well-being, you had mentioned that. And I felt, I've sort of been sitting here listening to what followed on from that. And I feel that the sense of self is very directly related to that. And that what the sense of well-being is I think what she's saying is releasing the constant struggle to shore up this illusion of self. And it's a constant struggle. It's based on tying threads of memory together, forming a story, keeping that story together. And the reason why I think it's so enervating, it's so contracting, is precisely because the self is not ultimately real. Mm. So it's this constant struggle to keep this illusion going.
That's right.
And shore it up. And that it seems, when you said that term, the sense of well-being, I thought, oh, that's just like saying, oh, I can actually let go of that. It may not ultimately be necessary.
Yeah.
And this image of what you're saying is sort of like spider webs kind of forming around this, around something with the hollows.
Yeah, yeah. And it's there's so much dukkha in that, precisely because it's not real. And how could it be otherwise?
And what's so funny is it's always going on. I mean, we've already, all of us have already lost everything. We already have lost the me that we thought we were many times over.
And yet we've never actually ever lost anything because there was nothing real
that was real
to lose.
That's right.
Right.
But from that solidification comes all of this emotional reactivity, and the kleshas arise. And I just read something today, which I never put these two words together. So the actual origin of dukkha goes way back, I guess, Aryan, and the other, and it has to do with an axle.
Yes,
an axle. And sukha is bliss, or blessing, or, peace. So sukha is the other piece. So if you're going, your axle's going over a rough road, that's like bumpy road. That's suffering, but if it's actually a smooth road, that's sweetness or bliss or peace. I thought that was very visual.
It's actually dukkha's axles.
Dukkha is the literal root of it is an axle in an ill-fitting hole.
Uh-huh.
to me, suffering has never been a very good definition or
word.
I mean, friction is actually friction the closest direct
resistance.
I'm sorry. So dukkha is the Pali term for suffering. So with that case, I talked about Pali is the language. Earliest Buddhist language the earliest Buddhist text.
I always thought that was that's a great way of describing it.
Yeah.
I always thought that was a good name. I have a pet. She's a Boston Terrier, and I call her Dukkha because she basically, she sees a treat. That's all the blinders are on. She starts she just wants to just avert the pain and start shivering. But the friction is good.
Sometimes unsatisfying.
Yeah,
It's literally, it comes from a cart, the axle, and the two holes that hold the axle. So an axle that doesn't fit well in the holes for
wiggles around.
Wiggles.
Kind of waggles.
So square peg and round hole.
Yeah.
So suffering is like things are always off. And yeah. there's always this rubbing. There's yeah. always this irritation
yeah,
or rub. Or
whereas the word word suffering, I think, in English is a little too dramatic.
Yeah.
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 Yeah. Irritation. I don't
yeah.
know.
Irritation.
Yeah,
more specific. It's more specific.
But it can be much bigger than
and that's what with the korwa, that's another
circle.
Word that I
that's
oh,
circling. Circling.
Yeah, that's
recycling.
Recycling.
Circling
of
round
suffering.
And round and round and
this is good.
So
yeah.
You introduced this what you read of Elizabeth Namgyal, and she you said commissioned a image, a painting. And it's actually a picture of Prajnaparamita.
Mm-hmm.
And Prajnaparamita is feminine. Does anyone find that strange?
I don't know what you mean. I mean, Prajnaparamita is the perfection of wisdom, right?
Yes. Yes.
It's not my teacher.
It's
the image. There's an image of.
Why should the image be feminine?
Maybe non-aggressive.
Why not?
Yeah.
Emptiness. Yeah, I think.
Why do you think it should be neither male nor female? Like
at some level it is, but it's also, if it's going to be pictured, it's going to be feminine.
She's called the mother. The mother of.
Of wisdom.
Wisdom.
The mother of all phenomena. The womb.
The womb.
From which all phenomena.
The emptiness comes.
Anything
occurs. Everything comes
everything
from
comes
that
from
space.
That
everything comes from space. And we say emptiness, but it's not just nothingness.
Right.
It's actually full of possibilities.
Fullness of emptiness.
Yeah. So is space another word for
emptiness? And it can be imaged as a womb.
I mean, Carl's book on the Heart Sutra, the introduction to the Heart Attack Sutra, he talks about the circle being the zero and the meaning of that in, I guess, Sanskrit, and the fact that it's like a balloon. That image of a balloon is a good one. There's just space there, so that form is barely there, but really the emptiness quality or the space is provided in that circle. Anyway, he says it better than I do. But
there was a wonderful image made by Chögyam Trungpa Rinpoche that he taught one of his early students when he drew a picture of what. He drew a picture and everybody was very self-conscious and it looked like a bird. Do you remember this?
No.
And people were like, oh, there's got to be something really other than that. So finally one person went and said, it's a white piece of paper, right, with this image on it. Said, it's a bird. And Rinpoche said, no, that's the sky. He drew a picture of the sky. Everybody was focusing on this, this, and what he was drawing. So that's how we talk about emptiness. So that it's very interesting.
Oh, so bird was just giving the hint that what he really was drawing.
Exactly. In a way, the bird placed the sky.
Yeah.
Right.
So it's we're flipping our conventional use of
all thoughts vanish like the imprint of a bird in the sky.
That's it. Brilliant.
Yeah.
Okay. All right, we're cooked, guys.